From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, commanding NATO's first war, we talk with Wesley Clark, who was the supreme Allied commander of NATO during the war with Yugoslavia. In the spring of 1999, his mission was to stop ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. He's written a new memoir called Waging Modern War. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg got so many responses to his commentary on linguistic anachronisms in movies that he's written a response to the responses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senator James Jeffords is heading home to Vermont to meet with constituents. Aides and Senate colleagues say he'll announce that he's leaving the Republican Party. The move would hand control of the chamber over to Democrats, giving them influence over the legislative agenda and over President Bush's nominees for judgeships. The Senate has approved a $1.35 trillion tax cut plan, gaining praise from President Bush, who says the tax cut will be a shot in the arm for the economy. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The Senate voted 62-38 in favor of the package, which spreads the tax cuts out over an 11-year period. At the White House, President Bush called it a victory for the American people, but he also pointed out that before the legislation can come to him for his signature, some Senate changes still must be reconciled with the version approved by the U.S. House. He said he hopes that happens this week.
The sooner the Congress completes its work, the sooner the American people will have their own money in their own pockets to save and invest as they see fit. Our economy cannot afford any further delays.
The tax cut is a result of a compromise with moderate Democrats and Republicans after the president failed to get the $1.6 trillion 10-year cut he pushed for from his first days in office. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
House Republicans failed today in an attempt to restore President Bush's plan to provide public funding for private schools to the education funding plan. The amendment would have provided vouchers of up to $1,500 per year to help poor students attend private schools if their public schools are deemed to be failing. Opponents say the plan would drain money away from public schools without providing poor students enough money to pay for private school tuition. The head of the President's Council of Economic Advisers says the U.S. economy is not currently in a recession. NPR's John Idstey reports.
It's widely expected that the government will report Friday that the first quarter growth rate was under 2% annually. But testifying on Capitol Hill, White House economic adviser Glenn Hubbard said that despite the recent slowdown, growth is expected to remain positive. Hubbard suggested that unemployment will likely continue to rise over the next several months, though, and that could depress consumer spending and hinder the pace of a recovery. The unemployment rate has risen to 4.5% in recent months from a 30-year low last autumn. Hubbard said he expects the effects of higher oil prices to dissipate over the next year, and he predicted a rebound in the battered information technology sector by the end of this year. Hubbard said higher productivity growth makes the long-term outlook for the U.S. economy bright. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 151 points, or 1.3%, to close at 11,105. The Nasdaq lost 67 points, or nearly 3%. This is NPR News. The jury in the embassy bombing case is adjourned after its 10th day of deliberations. The New York jury is working its way through hundreds of counts against four men accused of involvement in the 1998 bombings of American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed 224 people, including 12 Americans. The Census Bureau released demographic information today for 16 states, including New Jersey, California, and Florida. Today's numbers show Michigan's population is aging and becoming more diverse. Michigan Radio's Matt Schaefer-Powell reports.
Like most of the nation, Michiganians are growing older. The median age in Michigan is now about 35 and a half. A decade ago, that was closer to 32 and a half. While the number of retirees in Michigan rose substantially during the 90s, today's census figures show that young adults left the state in droves, a 12% drop since the last census. A large majority of Michigan's residents are white, but the state saw a huge influx of those claiming Asian and Indian descent, a jump of 129%. Hispanic numbers grew too, but Hispanics in Michigan still only make up a little over 3% of the population. And today's figures show that the state's older, more diverse residents are finding it harder to say, "I do." The number of households led by married couples fell about 4%. For NPR News, I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
A 14-year-old from Shoreline, Washington has won the National Geographic Bee. Kyle Haddad Fonda won the contest in Washington, D.C. by correctly identifying the part of a glacier where melting takes place. It's called the Zone of Ablation. He won a $25,000 scholarship. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services and its employees working together in its Stop Hunger program on the web at sodexomarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. General Wesley Clark says he had to learn a new kind of war as he was fighting it. As the supreme Allied commander of NATO, Clark was the head of the military chain of command within Europe during the operations against Yugoslavia. In the spring of 1999, NATO's mission was to end the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. Clark says this was modern war, the first war fought in Europe in half a century, and the first ever fought by NATO. His new memoir is called Waging Modern War. Clark served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO from 1997 to 2000. During the Gulf War, he commanded the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California. I spoke to him about commanding NATO forces in the military action against Yugoslavia. I asked him about the problems inherent in a coalition war fought by a 19-nation alliance with a multinational chain of command.
I think that fundamental to a coalition is the idea that different nations have different national interests. And that was certainly the case here. It's a problem that we've talked about theoretically in NATO for years. We always talked about the problem of strengthening the transatlantic link, and we talked about the burden-sharing problem, and people say, well, the interests of the Europeans are different than the interests of the Americans. Well, of course, every country has different interests. And in the case of this operation, countries like Italy and Greece, Hungary were directly affected economically. Hungary had a large minority of Hungarians, 370,000, living inside Serbia. So they were concerned for that reason. Germany had been the largest, had borne the brunt of the refugees coming out of former Yugoslavia. It spent $20 billion on refugees. So the prospect of another 1.5 million Albanians flooding into Germany and occupying schools and disrupting life there was certainly a hot political topic. France was interested in economic developments in the region and had an historic relationship with Serbia. And the United States was interested in NATO and trying to preserve the arrangements that we'd negotiated in Bosnia. So everybody had a slightly different interest. Some of the interests were all in common, but they were also slightly different. And that's the most fundamental problem about a coalition operation. How do you keep nations engaged, committing their forces, committing their prestige, the survivability of their government, in fact, to an operation when their interests vary so widely?
What was a typical disagreement between the countries? Did the countries disagree on what the best targets were?
Well, there were disagreements on the targets, the pace of the escalation, the use of the Apaches and how the Apaches would be used. There were disagreements about whether there'd be a movement toward a ground operation, what kind of ground operation it would be. In fact, there were differences of opinion on almost everything. Some were real disagreements, some were questioning. But every nation wanted its voice heard, and the art of coalition leadership was to give an audience in proportion to the commitment of the countries. So the countries that contribute the most to the operation have the largest say in the operation, the greatest influence on its outcome.
So what are the typical problems it cost for you as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO to know that the countries of NATO were disagreeing about what the goal should be and what the tactics should be?
Of course, it's a burden, but that's the leadership challenge that one expects in an alliance operation. NATO was patterned on the U.S.-British alliance from World War II, and that alliance was governed by a military committee consisting of the combined chiefs of staff, and General Eisenhower was the supreme Allied commander. during that period, and he set up NATO in that image. But of course, as we went from 2 countries to 19 countries, many more voices came in. And as the issue became not the defeat of Nazi Germany, but rather the imposition of a diplomatic settlement on Serbia and halting its ethnic cleansing, the issues became more complicated, more political, and more legal. But the greatest problem and the greatest challenge of this really is to preserve to our adversary the idea that NATO is cohesive and monolithic and relentless in pursuit of its objective, because any sign that the alliance on the inside was asking these questions back and forth and people were disagreeing and so forth might give hope to, might have given hope to Slobodan Milosevic, and probably did give hope to Slobodan Milosevic, that if he would just hang on and endure a few more days of the bombing, that everything would be all right and he'd be able to break NATO's will.
NATO is trying to give a real united front, even though there are divisions within NATO.
Exactly.
The rules of NATO are that you're supposed to follow your country if your country disagrees with a NATO decision. Did that happen?
Well, as a matter of fact, it did happen. And it's always been the case in NATO that forces that are put within NATO are essentially under NATO for specific purposes, but they remain fundamentally national forces. So in the case of the operation at the very end, when we were trying to occupy Kosovo with the NATO force and the Russians rushed in front of us, we asked the British commander to order the American helicopters to occupy the airfield so the Russians couldn't land their aircraft during the hours of darkness, and the British commander refused. And I went to him the next morning, it was Sunday morning, the 13th of June, and we talked about these issues, and he said, finally, I said to him, look, you're going to have to either accept this order or you're going to have to resign your position from the chain of command because you're a NATO commander. He said, okay, I understand. I'll accept the order. He said, but let me put British armored vehicles on the airfield instead of American helicopters, because the British armored vehicles will be much more effective at blocking the runways. I said, fine, go ahead. He then had one of his subordinates call London, and when he gave the order, London then blocked the order. It's called red carding. It wasn't technically disobedient or insubordinate. It's the way NATO operations work. London didn't want to take the risk of blocking the airfield, even though the United States did. And this man, working with his national government, frustrated the will of Washington and the overall orders of NATO.
So it's hard, I guess, for you at the top of the chain of command to run into that. But looking at it as objectively as you can, do you think that that ability to red card is a good thing within the NATO alliance?
Well, I think that the United States insists on it. It's just that it hasn't happened so often to United States officers, because we're normally in charge of operations when we commit our forces to them. And so for the United States team, the Allied commander and the American commander are one and the same person, so there's no conflict. But as we encourage our allies to do more, and as we stand back and refuse to take a leadership position, then if we put American troops in there, our troops are going to confront these issues. We have confronted them to some extent already in Kosovo, where there has been some limited notice of public squabbling about whether American troops would operate out of sector or not and help other countries, with our national command authorities saying, no, we're not going to share our troops' skills, we're not going to take any risks out of these sectors unless there's an emergency, whereas other nations were more generous and were offering their troops to come into our sector and help us. So that has posed a dilemma, but it's not a dilemma that we're as familiar with as other nations are. We're going to become more familiar, however, I think, in the future.
You write in your book, I was torn between the guidance and perspective I gained from NATO, heavily influenced by the Department of State and the White House, and what I would hear in my U.S. military chain reporting to the Pentagon. From one side, I was continually exhorted to do the best I could to accomplish the task at hand. From the other, I was often implicitly or explicitly constrained in seeking resources and authority to act. Talk a little bit more about the different messages that you were getting from the White House and State Department and from the Pentagon?
I did operate in two chains of command. As a U.S. military commander, I was a regional commander-in-chief, commander of the U.S. European Command, and I reported through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to the Secretary of Defense. The U.S. National Military Strategy considered that operations in Europe were secondary to importance to the importance of preparing for operations in Korea or the Persian Gulf. It was what was known as the National Military Strategy. This was begun as a resourcing strategy to explain why to the American people in Congress we needed to explain why we needed to keep the forces that we had, roughly 60% of what we had during the Cold War. And over time, it transformed itself into becoming an operational strategy, with the Pentagon saying, we're not interested in doing anything unless it's in these two particular theaters. We don't want to impede readiness to go to war by doing these other secondary tasks. But the unfortunate truth was that reality was intruding here. We had Americans on the ground, we had national prestige and commitment, and we had our NATO alliance committed to operations in the Balkans. And once an alliance commits to operations, then success is absolutely essential. So in the U.S. chain, I was constantly aware of other priorities. We're going to put the aircraft carriers in the Pacific, or they're going into the Persian Gulf. You can't have an aircraft carrier during this period. Okay, I understand that. But in the NATO channels, there was constant exhortation and urging to do better. It was imperative to prevent an outbreak of ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. It was important to see that the Dayton Agreement in Bosnia was successfully implemented, and that took resources. And so there was a certain amount of tension in Washington in the interagency between the State Department, which wanted to see the missions done and wanted to use Defense Department resources to do them, and the Defense Department, which had its own agenda. And that tension was played out through my command.
My guest is General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. His new memoir is called Waging Modern War. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. General Wesley Clark is my guest, and he was the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO during the NATO bombing of Kosovo. He's written a new memoir about that period called Waging Modern War. Now, when it came time to decide on targets, you had to have the targets approved by your country. So what were the differences between what the State Department and what the Pentagon wanted in terms of targets?
Well, in the target approval process, the State Department really shouldn't have much say. This is a military matter, and it goes up then through legal channels and military channels as high as is necessary. And in this case, the targets were approved by the White House. I'm sure that the representatives from the State Department probably saw the targets, but and they were certainly welcome to make suggestions, but I don't know of any major disagreements on those particular issues with respect to targeting. I think the issue there was that the Americans and our European allies had differing views about what to bomb and when and why. For the American military, strategic bombing has always been a panacea. It's been something we hoped would help us avoid a ground war. Strategic bombing is the outgrowth of the terrible slaughter in the trenches of World War I, but only the United States had the resources and the scientific know-how to develop this fully. And, of course, during the Cold War, we relied on strategic aircraft, the Strategic Air Command, and finally on intercontinental ballistic missiles in an extension of strategic bombing to provide deterrence. The European allies never developed the capabilities nor the concepts for strategic bombing. For them, strategic bombing was associated with their personal experiences with destroyed, devastated cities and thousands of casualties. And when we started looking at escalating the campaign, I remember the German General Klaus Naumann came to me and he said, Wes, He said, you must be very careful. He said, Germany bombed Belgrade in 1941. I think the date was the 6th of April. 17,000 people were killed in Belgrade. We must never do such a thing again. And of course, these were the memories of Europe. But to the Americans, strategic bombing was a great success during the Second World War. And it's something that our independent Air Force has extolled as one of its great capabilities. And so we started with a fundamental divergence on our approach to the use of air power. The Europeans wanting to go after the tactical targets, take greater risks, fly lower, try to hit the Serb tanks and the artillery and any other equipment that was deployed out in the field. The Americans wanting to go strategic, hit downtown Belgrade's key communications facilities and headquarters, and so on. And it was this divergence, really, which was at the center of many of the difficulties in escalating the campaign.
So how did you negotiate those two different points of view?
I tried to do both. And both sides were actually, they were relatively tolerant. We were able to escalate both the strategic attacks and the efforts tactically. But the American side quickly lost faith in the ability to strike the Serb forces on the ground. I had asked for the Apache helicopters to come and augment the United States Air Force capabilities in doing this because I felt that by moving at night with the Apaches, with their ability to fly low, to get under the weather, to use their infrared acquisition, they'd be much more effective at picking up the enemy targets than aircraft flying at 15 to 20,000 feet. And the Europeans certainly supported this concept, but the Pentagon really didn't support the concept. Nevertheless, we were able to increase the intensity of the strikes, attack a broader array of targets, and ultimately I think we brought a significant degree of punishment against Milosevic's infrastructure and his key means of command and control. We had to be very careful in doing so that we were scrupulously in compliance with international law. No attacking civilian targets, no use of civilians, no punishment of civilians intended to cause them to rebel against the government, strictly military or militarily connected targets.
It's such an ambiguous line there between what's a military target and what's punishing citizens. Because first of all, let's face it, if you're bombing all night and citizens are lying awake, terrified in their homes or in bomb shelters, that's kind of punishing citizens right there. Then when you take out the electricity and citizens don't have electricity, that's punishing them. When they're not safe in their own city, when the water isn't reliable anymore, when the bridges are bombed. I mean, that's punishing citizens as well as Milosevic.
There's always some ambiguity in this. We had lawyers, our Department of Justice, our Attorney General, looked at this very carefully and made sure that we stayed within the bounds of international law. But you're quite right. There's no avoiding the impact on the civilian population of military activities. And certainly that impact was felt in this case. It was something I worried about every night as I looked at the targets, because not only do you impact on the civilians by taking out the electricity and so forth, but there's always a chance that a bomb will go astray or that the blast will affect people in their own homes at night. And I worried about this every single day of the campaign. We did everything we possibly could to reduce the chances of harming civilians, but still, it's inevitable that in war there will be civilian casualties.
Figuring out what the outcome of the bombing would be depends in part on what you figure Milosevic's personality is and what he's likely to do in reaction to the bombing. What kind of debates do you have within NATO about Milosevic's personality?
Well, it's interesting that Milosevic was a well-known figure to many people in Europe. I probably knew him as well as anybody. Richard Holbrooke, Ambassador Chris Hill, who was in Macedonia, and I had more personal time with Milosevic probably than anybody else, and certainly more than anyone in the intelligence community did. And
let me say that's because you participated in the Dayton Accords,
the
peace process that ended the war.
While I was Supreme Allied Commander before the fighting began, I visited Milosevic on several occasions. I talked to him by telephone other times, and so I continued to maintain currency with Milosevic and his outlook. My last visit to him was a couple of months before the war started, and I spent 7 hours with him General Klaus Naumann and I flew down and tried to talk through where he was in January of 1999. So we were relatively current on Milosevic and his thinking. Milosevic is a stubborn man. He's a rational man. He's a calculating man, and he's a self-interested man. And so even though he told us in January of 1999 that Kosovo was more important than his head, I never believed that. I always believed that he would much rather lose Kosovo than lose his head. And it was up to us to place that choice directly in front of him. And ultimately, that's what happened. NATO was, and NATO nations were less certain than I was about this. Some believed that Milosevic might actually crumble with the first wave of NATO aircraft. And I couldn't say that was an impossibility. Anything's possible, but I doubted that would happen. Others believed that Milosevic would give in after a few days, that he just needed a little bit of destruction in order to excuse this. I believed from the outset that this was going to be a stubborn, difficult opponent, and we were going to have to demonstrate our mastery of his armed forces and our ability to decisively defeat him before he would surrender. And it was unpredictable how long that would take. As it turned out, it took 78 days.
General Wesley Clark is the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. His new memoir is called Waging Modern War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Serbia. We continue our conversation with retired General Wesley Clark. He commanded the NATO forces during the Kosovo conflict. And Jeff Nunberg responds to our many listeners who commented on his piece about linguistic anachronisms in the movies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with retired General Wesley Clark. He was the supreme Allied commander of NATO troops in Europe during the military action against Serbia in the spring of 1999. The mission was to end the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. Clark has written a new memoir called Waging Modern War. During the NATO bombing of Serbia, the Chinese embassy was accidentally bombed. I asked General Clark what went wrong.
I think there was a long chain of events that led to the Chinese embassy mistake. It began with the fact that it's much more difficult to collect information on what to strike in an air campaign than one might presuppose. There are always a few obvious targets. One would say, well, of course, you'll strike these airfields. Sure, we'll strike airfields. Will you strike enemy barracks? Well, you might strike headquarters and logistics facilities. Do you know where they are? Well, we think we do. And this may add up to a couple of 300 targets, but after you've gone through those obvious targets, and the question is, what else is there? And to get the answers to those questions, you can't look at photographs or maps. You have to go to people who really understand the enemy. And you go to all the people in your government who know something about them. In this case, there was a man at the Central Intelligence Agency who nominated a particular target, and that target, he believed, was controlling the export of Serbian technology and arms abroad, and by implication was responsible also for importing foreign military assistance into Serbia. And it was certainly in that case, it was a logical military target for us to strike. He believed he knew the address of it. He'd never seen the building from the air. He picked it out. He thought it was the right building by knowing other buildings on other streets, and he passed it into the system, and it passed through several filters that should have caught the mistake.
And they didn't.
But they didn't. And ultimately, a lot of it was he also bypassed a couple of filters. But, you know, he'd been there on the ground, and he was from a responsible agency, and people were working 24 hours a day, and it got fed into the system. And I remember carrying the sheet of paper up to Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he took it to Sandy Berger and the president's national security advisor. We all looked at the picture. We all looked at the description. It all made sense, and we approved the strike. So it came out of the approval was actually at the White House. And we did execute the strike, and obviously it was a tragic mistake.
What needed to be fixed after that mistake?
We went back in several different directions. First, we made sure we tightened up the system so that it was impossible to bypass these loops that would have double-checked and triple-checked the identification of buildings and so forth. Secondly, we went to each of our NATO allies again. We'd already done this once. We went again and we said, now tell us again exactly what targets cannot be struck. We always maintained what's called a no-strike list. And this was the churches and the embassies and the schools and the hospitals and the community facilities and all of the civilian facilities that you don't want to hit. So we went back and revalidated that. And then we just really used the elbow grease. We checked every single target that we had on our books again before we executed any more missions. And we were very, very careful.
What do you go through emotionally when you find out that the Chinese embassy was accidentally hit?
Well, it was worrisome, but I have to be honest with you and tell you I was a lot more worried and a lot more upset when we struck at an alleged Serb police station at Karisa. I think the date was the 11th of May. And inside, it was not a police station. It was a holding area, and 80 Albanians had been locked inside by the Serbs and threatened that they would be shot if they left. We identified it as a Serb police station. We bombed it that night. We killed 80 Albanians. These were the very people we were trying to help. It was a horrible, tragic mistake. And that was truly something that had an significant emotional impact on the command and on those of us who had who had pushed for the attack of targets like this. In the case of the Chinese embassy, we had a systems problem, and it was terrible. It was a problem that was dealt with at a very high level. It had enormous implications for the United States government and for NATO, but within the command, it had less of an impact than the deaths of so many innocent Albanian civilians, the very people we were trying to help.
So what do you tell yourself after 80 civilians were accidentally killed?
You say you've got to do everything you can to prevent something like that happening again. But you're still faced with the responsibility of carrying forth the campaign. And it becomes a matter of relative evils. We were opposing a man who was determined to carry out an ethnic cleansing that was going to force 1.5 million people out of the country, or out of their homes at the very least. We didn't know how many people he'd killed. We're still saying about 10,000. We know bodies were carried out in refrigerator vans and burned in furnaces and other things, but we'll never know exactly how many people died there. But this was a deliberate effort perpetrated by a government on its own citizens. In contrast, when we tried to stop it, accidents occurred. It was the best that we could do with modern technology, the full effort of all of the intelligence communities, and the best adherence to international law. It just wasn't perfect. And it may not have been, it certainly wasn't everything we wanted. It certainly wasn't good enough, but it was the best that we could do at the time. It's a terrible dilemma that we place people in uniform in, and especially for the men and women who flew the aircraft and who had their hands on the pickle and dropped the ordnance on those targets. I prayed for them every day and night because I knew the terrible pressures they were under.
You and the other commanders of NATO were not only very concerned about civilian casualties in Kosovo, you were concerned about NATO casualties. And you gave an order to, you know, limit the loss of any aircraft, limit the loss of casualties. It certainly seems like there's much more fear of military casualties now, and that there has been since the Gulf War, than any time before the Gulf War. And I like your analysis of why there is much more concern about military casualties now.
I think it's a carryover from Vietnam. Certainly, in this case, the reason that we put out instructions, we put out what I called measures of merit. And we wanted to be able to assess ourselves each day how well we were moving along the path to success in the campaign. And I established very quickly four measures of merit, and they were avoiding the loss of aircraft, impacting the Serb forces on the ground, avoiding damages and harm to innocent civilians, and maintaining alliance cohesion. These were four mutually inconsistent objectives. We had to trade off one from the other. You want to do more against the Serb forces on the ground, then you take greater risks with your aircraft. You want to be more careful in avoiding incidents of collateral damage, then you take more risks with your aircraft. You want to do more to help the alliance maintain cohesion, then you are more careful to avoid instances of harming civilians on the ground. And so these were, because they were inconsistent objectives fundamentally, then we used them to trade off. So it wasn't an order to avoid these things. We were trying to get the best balance. And we knew that we had to avoid losing aircraft because we had to keep the momentum of success. We had to have the public in Western nations and the Serb leadership believing that NATO success was inevitable. If we had begun the campaign by losing 6 aircraft, then we would have begun to undercut our ability to achieve that momentum of success.
My guest is General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. His new memoir is called Waging Modern War. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is General Wesley Clark, and he was the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO from 1997 to 2000. His new book, Waging Modern War, is a memoir about the bombing of Kosovo. What were some of the things you would have liked to do about ethnic cleansing on the ground as you were waging an air war against Serbia?
Well, obviously, we wanted to be able to strike the forces that were conducting the ethnic cleansing. You can't do that from aircraft. That's why I asked for the Apaches to come in. I thought that with the Apaches, the ability to go in at night close, we'd be able to attack and harass these forces, break them up, and stop the ethnic cleansing.
What were you able to do?
We were able to strike eventually at some of the assembly areas and at some of the Serb forces and inflict some punishment through the use of B-52 strikes and precision bombing by aircraft at high altitude. But we had to be very careful because of the problem of civilian casualties, and so it did restrict the operations. We impacted the forces to some degree, but not to the extent that I had sought.
In your estimation, what really ended the war?
I think the fact that Milosevic realized he had no way out, and it came down to the choice of Kosovo or his head, and he gave up Kosovo rather than losing his head. He would have lost his army, he would have lost Kosovo, and he had no chance for success, and the loss of his army would have doomed him.
You write in your book that although NATO had succeeded in its first armed conflict, it didn't feel like a victory. In what way didn't it feel like a victory?
Well, for one reason it didn't feel like a victory is because we were never satisfied with our ability to have stopped the ethnic cleansing cold. We didn't. We had to deal with hundreds of thousands of people who'd been forced out of Kosovo, and these people went through tremendous hardship. We knew that 10,000 or more had been killed inside Kosovo, so we couldn't celebrate a triumph in the face of losses like that. But it also was only a prelude to the operation to put ground troops into Kosovo, and we all recognized there'd be a great deal of difficulty in doing this. But I think a final reason was that NATO had never actually fought before. And when statesmen and military leaders in NATO were engaged in the action and they realized what was at stake, they realized how difficult the situation was, the terrible choices they were faced with, the awful dilemma of bombing and causing civilian casualties, or not bombing and causing the destruction of NATO. They made the right choices, but they were very painful choices, and it wasn't a pain that they would willingly accept or even want to relive. There was no spirit of joy at the end of this operation.
One thing about this war was that it wasn't officially called a war. What did you think of that? Do you think that we should have just said, this is a war against Milosevic? Or do you think it was right to not use the word war, even though we were bombing the heck out of Serbia?
Well, we always called it a war inside the military. We just didn't say it publicly. For the pilots flying over and being shot at by missiles and so forth, there was no doubt that this was a war. And I'm sure for the Albanians who were being forced out of their homes at gunpoint and shot and raped and so forth, it was certainly a war. The question was, what does the label mean? As one of the European statesmen said to me after the war, he said, in Italy, you could not use the word war. War meant devastation, destruction, death, defeat, occupation. It was not possible to say the word war. He said, now we have won one. How we label it is much less important than how we do it.
What are some of your criticisms of the Pentagon during the bombing of Kosovo while you were Supreme Allied Commander of NATO?
Well, I think that it's very hard to answer. I'm not being critical of the Pentagon simply during the bombing. What I'm suggesting is that there's a whole array of lessons that need to be learned and taken out of this. The Pentagon has its own institutional interests. The Pentagon's not the right place to originate U.S. foreign policy. When it prepares war plans, those plans are illustrative. They may be demanding in terms of resources, but they shouldn't be restrictive in terms of limiting where military power can be used. It has to be used where the president, the commander-in-chief, wants it to be used for the purposes that he directs. During the campaign, it's appropriate to support the field commander, and there will always be a give and take with the Pentagon and with higher headquarters, and the field commander should be expected to push hard. He should be expected to push hard, and he should be expected to ask for more than he expects to get. And that's the way I said it. There are frictions in any big operation, just like there are frictions in business or publishing or any other activity. But one expects that the frictions will be, they'll be subordinate to the teamwork and the spirit of cooperation and ultimately submerged in the success of the endeavor.
In this case,
they weren't.
What are the institutional interests of the Pentagon that may be in conflict with the decision-making required to wage war?
Well, in this case, the institutional interests were a desire to not become engaged in the Balkans in conflict because there was an effort to increase the size of the procurement budget so more money could be spent building up the armed forces rather than using them. It's like putting all your money into buying a large boat and not having enough money to run it.
Right, okay.
In this case, we couldn't afford the diversion of resources to engage in the campaign because it would have detracted from the amount of money we were going to put into the procurement account.
Oh, I see. So instead of spending the money to wage war, they wanted to spend the money to buy more equipment.
Right.
To wage war
right.
in the future.
Right.
Okay.
It was a conflict of the present versus the future.
The U.S. is not exactly highly regarded in many areas of the U.N. right now. do you have any concerns about the future of the United States in the United Nations?
Well, I hope the United States is going to recognize that it's the greatest beneficiary of the world set of institutions and structures that we ourselves established at the end of the Second World War. We've got to be participants, active participants in these institutions. We've got to be engaged in the world. Communism's dead. It's time to go out and help our friends and those who share our values, and that means active participation and leadership in the United Nations. We very much need to do this. And when we recognize this, then I'm sure that we'll be more highly regarded in institutions such as the United Nations.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
General Wesley Clark is the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. His new memoir is called Waging Modern War. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg on the usage of the word gay as a synonym for homosexual. This is Fresh Air. Several of our listeners took issue with something that our linguist Jeff Nunberg recently said. Here's his response.
In a Fresh Air commentary I did a couple of weeks ago on linguistic anachronisms in movies, I mentioned that the word gay wasn't yet a neutral mainstream word for homosexuals back in 1973. After the piece ran, I heard from a number of people who pointed out that gay had been in the language for a long time before that. Several of them mentioned the use of the word in Howard Hawks' 1938 screwball classic, Bringing Up Baby. It comes in a scene where Cary Grant has lost his clothes and puts on a frilly woman's robe to answer the door to Mae Robson, who plays Katharine Hepburn's Aunt Elizabeth.
Well, who are you?
Who are you?
Well, who are you?
What do you want?
Well, who are you?
I don't know. I'm not quite myself today.
Well, you look perfectly idiotic in those clothes.
These aren't my clothes.
Well, where are your clothes?
I've lost my clothes.
But why are you wearing these clothes?
Because I just went gay all of a sudden.
A modern audience registers that exchange with a knowing wink. But it isn't clear how the line would have been taken back then. It's true the word gay was being used to refer to homosexuals as early as the 30s, but it was a label known only to initiates. One lexicographer said in 1941 that it was an adjective used almost exclusively by homosexuals. And many years later, Edmund White recalled that gay had served for years as a shibboleth to exclude outsiders. That's the sense you get from Gore Vidal's 1948 novel, The City and the Pillar, about a young man's arrival in the homosexual world of New York. Jim discovered their language, their expressions. The words fairy and pansy were considered to be in bad taste. It was considered fashionable to say that a person was gay. So it isn't likely that straight audiences who went to see Bringing Up Baby in 1938 would have interpreted Grant's line as a reference to homosexuality. It could have been a Hollywood in-joke, of course, though that would have been a risky thing for Grant to do. Probably he was just using gay in another common sense at the time to mean simply frisky or wild. Gay didn't start to come out of the closet until 30 years after Bringing Up Baby was released. In 1966, Time magazine ran a story called The Gay Subculture, though it was careful to put gay in quotation marks, the orthographic equivalent of holding it with tweezers. And the word still had a fey, slangy connotation in June of 1969, when a group of lesbians and gay men resisted a routine police raid at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, and the cry of gay power was first heard. According to Edmund White, who was present, that phrase evoked general laughter from the crowd. As he puts it, most of us did not consider ourselves to be a legitimate minority. At the time, a lot of people said that homosexuals didn't have a right to the word. Some complained that the new use ruined the festive sense of gay. Arthur M. Schlesinger accused homosexuals of trying to kidnap the word. And the critic Jacques Barzin said that it robbed the language of an irreplaceable resource. And in what amounts to pretty much the same thing, other people argued that the word was inappropriate because gay life was actually very sad. But within a few years, gay was becoming a neutral substitute for homosexual, and the press was using the word without apologies. The 70s was the period of the great renaming, as Americans decided that groups have a right to be called by whatever term they choose to apply to themselves. And in that sense, the acceptance of gay paralleled the acceptance of words like black and Latino. What was unusual about gay was that it brought another word along with it, as the press began to refer to heterosexuals as straights, which had also originated in the gay community. Straight has always been the ironic description that groups considered deviant or marginal have applied to the conventional mainstream. Criminals have been talking about going straight since the 19th century, and later on the word was used in much the same sense of opposition by the drug culture and the hippies. But until the 1970s, straight was always a label that came from the margins, not the way the dominant culture thought of itself. Trisha and Julie Nixon didn't sit around in the White House referring to themselves as "we straights." There aren't many cases where a majority has taken on the description it's assigned by a minority. The only other one that comes to mind is Gentile. But then heterosexuals couldn't have come to terms with gay until they had a colloquial way of referring to their own sexual orientation, which had never required an ordinary name before then. Gay, straight, there's an easy symmetry in the pairing, like identical twin beds. And some gays responded by reclaiming the epithet queer, which reintroduces some of the disparities and tensions that the acceptance of gay swept under the carpet. Queer is suffused with an irony that straights will have a hard time appropriating, at least until the derogatory use of the word can fade from memory. And it implicitly subverts the notion of straight as well. I asked a friend of mine who teaches cultural studies, "What's the antonym of queer? Is it still straight?" "Oh, no," she said. "To listen to the people around here, the fundamental social distinction is between the queer and the boring." In the end, though, things have gotten too complicated for any simple antitheses. Once the closet door was open, the bedroom floor was bound to get cluttered. One attempt to come to grips with this is the acronym GLBT for gay, lesbian, bi, and trans. But it's hard to believe things will stop there with a mere 5 sexual identities. It will be a long time before the vocabulary is straightened out, and in the meantime, we can all be reprising the conversation that Cary Grant and Mae Robson initiated 60 years ago.
Well, who are you?
Who are you?
Well, who are you?
What do you want?
Well, who are you?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Just a reminder, on Friday, we'll pay tribute to jazz singer Susanna McCorkle. She died last weekend. We'll close today's show with her 1995 recording of Cole Porter's Easy to Love.
I know too well that I'm just wasting precious time to think that such a thing could be, that you could ever care for me. I'm sure you hate to hear that I adore you, dear, but grant me just the same, I'm not entirely to blame for you'd be so easy to love, so easy to idolize all others above, so sweet to waken with, so nice to sit down to eggs and bacon with. We'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together, that it does seem a shame you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be, oh, so easy to love. You'd be so easy, so easy to love, so easy to idolize all others above, so worthy.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Cats and Men, a story collection by Nina de Grammont. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a history of breast cancer diagnosis and treatment in 20th century America. We talk with doctor and medical historian Baron Lerner, author of the new book, The Breast Cancer Wars. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.